and welcome to Beyond the Filter, a podcast about censorship. My name's Brandy.
And I'm Jeremy, and this is a special edition of Beyond the Filter that's also a webinar to launch the Drawing the Line watchlist. The Drawing the Line watchlist is a report of 10 countries around the world, and its headline finding is that the legal systems in most of those countries are blurring the line between personal expression, such as artwork and fiction, and lived abuse material with real victims. So I'll be talking more about the watch list in just a minute, but first, let's introduce the three special guests that we have with us today, who are all members of the advisory board for the Drawing the Line project.
Our first guest is Emma Shapiro, an independent expert and editor-at-large of Don't Delete Art, a global project advocating for artists facing censorship online. Emma has been at the front lines of documenting how platforms and governments restrict creative expression, often in the name of safety. Emma, you've seen firsthand how these blurred lines play out for artists. Can you tell us how the censorship of sex and nudity is affecting the communities you work with?
Hi, and thank you so much for inviting me to this discussion. I'm really thrilled to be part of this whole team, this advisory board, for this important topic. It is very close to my heart on many levels, and I'm really glad that it's being tackled by such brilliant minds. So, yeah, how is this playing out for artists online? So in my role as editor at large for Don't Delete Art, as you mentioned, we advocate for artists, visual artists who are facing content moderation issues and the fallout from like badly designed and implemented tech policy online. And many of those artists are artists who use the body or are dealing in sexual themes. And basically what we're dealing with is a continuation of kind of a moral panic that has been escalating in various directions for a very long time. And now in our online space, that should be a space where artists should all be able to access their audience, be able to earn a living the way that many other artists are able to do. It's a very uneven playing field for the art community. And then it has quite a big fallout into the major art market, like beyond the digital realm. This is something that has been provably affecting artists' livelihoods and our own access to art and culture online and offline. Something that a lot of artists are also concerned about right now, of course, is like AI's involvement in the content moderation process, as well as, you know, scraping their artwork for creating artwork of its own. But no matter what, whether it's that or it's a content moderation process, the risk is creating this homogenized, flat, expressionless art that we get to see, that we get to access, and that we get to make.
Thank you so much, Emma. I'd like to move on to introduce our second guest, Ashley Rominga, a graduate researcher in global culture and languages at the University of Tasmania. Ashley studies queer and transgender participation in fandom, how online creative communities build culture, connection, and sometimes resistance in the face of moral panic. Ashley, your work looks closely at how queer and trans creators navigate fandom spaces. How do these recurring moral panics around sexual or inappropriate content impact that participation?
Well, there's actually a really great example I had just a week ago when I was getting my ethics approval for my latest study on how gender diverse people interact with gender bending anime and manga. And the feedback I got back was, how are you going to address Lolicon? And that was like, well, I'm not looking at that because, you know, I'm trying to steer away as much as possible to get ethics approved as quick as possible. But just there was that inherent linkage to child sexual abuse material under the Australian law and trans and gender diverse people, which I found a really ironic linkage between the two. Just there was this inherent belief that these are going to be the same. But also we just see that a lot of, especially transgender diverse queer media doesn't necessarily always get translated, and therefore it doesn't go through the processes of the Australian law, which involves basically to legalize it to go through the classification board. So a lot of the media we have is unregulated. So a lot of queer media, you're sort of taking a gamble if you want to access it. So it puts a lot of queer people at risk of potentially breaching laws at the whims of Border Force or the Australian Federal Police or independent state governments. And I'm sure we'll talk about later on about the blurring of all these jurisdictions and overlaps and just the chaos it can cause. So it is hard because they're constantly blurring these ideas, and it makes researching queer media, makes researching fandom very difficult. And I was speaking at Mechademia, one of the wonderful Japanese pop culture conferences, and people were very surprised to learn how restrictive Australia's laws are when it comes to researching anime and manga. So so that in particular was a particularly bad issue.
Thank you, Ashley. Our third and final guest is Zora Rush, a linguist who works on responsible AI with Microsoft, developing systems to assess harmful content generation in large language models. Zora brings a fascinating dual lens, both linguist and technological, to the question of how we define and detect harm. Zora, maybe you can start there. As a linguist, how does the language we use around harmful or sexual content shape the way both people and algorithms come to interpret it?
Oh, what a question. It's the question that we're all grappling with right now, because from a linguistic lens, there are so few pieces of language that are in and of themselves harmful. It all depends on context, on where the content is being placed, on the consent of the people viewing that content, on how it is framed within an academic paper or on a platform where you understand how it's being used and you know the people that you're talking to. So the issue with any kind of thing that we describe as, you know, air quotes, harmful, is determining that context and figuring out the way that those things can linguistically manifest in ways that are right for a company's platform or within a large language model. When you're trying to identify them, you're thinking of how do I represent the breadth and depth of language and see how this can be presented. So it's definitely a difficult problem. Particularly with sexual content, it's highly intersectional. You end up looking at things like identity, race, gender, the way that these things pop up. But working with intersectional content at that level, you want to make sure that you're covering your bases and being very fair about it. Part of the issue is if you're trying to make sure that certain things are off limits within your content, the content that you allow, it may be extremely difficult to then allow things that you are okay with. So in some ways, the tech industry, I think, is a victim of its own success in that sometimes it makes these things look so good, look effortless. But finding that line and actually pulling that off from an engineering standpoint is incredibly complicated. And I think sometimes what you see on platforms that they might not be exceptionally public about is that they want more restrictions because they have not figured out how to restrict while allowing other things.
Thank you so much, Zora. We're going to turn back to our panelists in just a few minutes in an open discussion segment. But before that, I'm going to walk through a few of the findings and recommendations of the Drawing the Line watch list, which we are releasing today at drawingthelineprinciples.org. So the Drawing the Line watch list asks a simple but vital question. where do we draw the line in law, platform policies, and language between personal expression and lived abuse? So by personal expression, we're talking about works of art, fiction, sometimes education or advocacy. And by lived abuse, we're mostly talking about, you know, photos and videos of real acts of sexual violence, especially against children. The difference between them may seem obvious, but around the world, we're seeing that line become dangerously blurred. And that's what this report sets out to document. So the watch list came about because policymakers are increasingly treating personal sexual expression as though it were equivalent to real abuse. And we're seeing artists, writers, sex workers, educators, and queer communities caught up in laws and platform policies that were originally meant to protect real victims. And at the same time, agencies responsible for prosecuting real abuse cases are underfunded, overstretched, and sometimes repurposed to investigate content that doesn't harm anyone. So the goal was to map this global confusion and propose a rights-based way forward. So the report looks at 10 countries, the United States, Canada, Costa Rica, the United Kingdom, France, Denmark, Iran, Japan, South Korea, and Australia. And the idea was to cover a variety of different legal systems and traditions there, and to investigate how they all face that same challenge, the erosion of clear distinctions between real and imagined material. In each country, we looked at laws, enforcement trends, and policy debates, and we identified where reform was most urgently needed. So it is a comparative legal study, but at the end of the day, it's also an advocacy document. And the headline finding from the watch list is pretty stark. We found that governments are redirecting resources from protecting children to policing expression. Instead of going after traffickers and abusers, some jurisdictions are chasing down artists, writers, sex workers, and educators over fictional, artistic, or consensual adult content. So that shift doesn't make potential victims any safer. It creates a chilling effect or a chilling environment of censorship and moral panic over a broad field of sexual expression. The clearest example that we found is in the United Kingdom. From Freedom of Information data that we obtained, we found evidence of a significant drop in prosecutions over real child sexual abuse material to make way for an explosion in prosecutions over fictional material, which now makes up 40% of all image-based prosecutions there. So this reallocation of resources obviously means fewer detectives working on cases with actual victims. The UK isn't alone. We found in some of the other countries that we looked at, art galleries being raided in the United States, Canada, and Australia, artists in France and Denmark facing prosecution, women being targeted in South Korea, Japan, and Iran, and even a child being prosecuted in Costa Rica for drawings that she posted to her blog, with both the law and the prosecution of that specific teenager being pushed by foreign influences. So across all of these cases, we see the same pattern: moral panic driving policy, not evidence of harm. Obviously, this conflation has serious human rights consequences. It undermines the principle of legality. People can't know what's actually illegal anymore. It violates proportionality, punishing creators as though their work involved real abuse. And it chills queer, sexual, and artistic expression, especially for marginalized communities. And most of all, it distracts from the real goal, which should be preventing and prosecuting crimes with actual victims. The watch list proposes 5 key reforms to address this. And in this first edition of the watch list, we're focusing our recommendations on what governments can do. So firstly, have separate laws for real and fictional material. Secondly, have separate agencies. Don't mix censorship and child protection. Third, use precise terminology that doesn't conflate expression with sexual abuse. Fourth, ensuring proportionate penalties where no real harm is involved. And fifth, maintain separate statistical reporting for real sex crimes and censorship crimes. So one of the reasons why these reforms matter right now is because there is increasing pressure to broaden legal definitions and penalties to address concerns about the misuse of generative AI. And there are some safeguards needed to address offensive content, whether it's AI generated or otherwise. But the point that the watchlist makes is that watering down real child sexual abuse laws is not the correct way to address those concerns. And I hope that in our discussion period, we might touch on what are some better ways to do that. So once again, you can download the full Drawing the Line watchlist from drawingthelineprinciples.org. And you can also find a set of six guiding principles that our guests here today helped us to develop and that have guided our approach to this work. So please check it out. And in the meantime, Brandy, let's open up the conversation and hear a bit more from how each of our panelists are encountering these same tensions in their own work.
Thanks, Jeremy. That's really important work. And it wouldn't have been possible without the input from the Drawing the Line Project's advisory board, three members of which we've already heard from today. And I'd like to turn back to them now. Firstly, an open question to all of you. Why did you become involved with this project? And do you have any feedback on what Jeremy has presented? Emma, would you like to start?
So when I was approached to be part of the advisory group for this project, I was really grateful because I was looking for, like, I was ready for opportunities to be involved in this kind of research and this kind of publication of what is happening on the ground. This is like a real serious issue right now for artists as we're facing all these different kinds of like tech policy that's aimed at protecting children that seems to be going in very extreme directions and also being taken as a sort of baton by certain places and certain politicians in order to censor content that they don't agree with. And so it becomes a very dangerous landscape for free expression online and for visual artists online, especially marginalized ones. I am from the United States. I live in Europe, so I have my feet in sort of both policy places that are operating quite differently when it comes to tech policy, but I'm paying attention to both and aware of the strengths and weaknesses of each. In the United States, as far as I'm concerned, mostly weaknesses. But and I just see this to be a very pertinent conversation. Also, just one more thing to mention is that in advocating for visual artists online, you know, some people shy away from getting into the realm of talking about like erotic art or erotic artists. And they can often, even just in the art community, are often sidelined or just sort of corralled into their own expression group. And while it is a type of art and expression, they don't get defended as much as a lot of other fine artists. And it's been very important to me to sort of analyze those barriers, break down those barriers, because what is happening to that community online is happening to the rest of the art community too, and they just may not see it as clearly. But they're the canary in the coal mines just as much as like sex workers are the canary in the coal mines for a lot of online spaces. This is something that we need to be paying attention to and nip in the bud before it really comes for all of our expression.
How did you become involved in this project? And do you have any feedback on what Jeremy has presented? So Ashley, do you want to go next?
Yeah, sure. I came into this project mostly because I was seeing a lot of queer media being censored, especially disproportionate to other forms of media being censored, but also erotic media also being censored, and how the impact of this media was being censored. And also I just couldn't get past the ironies within the Australian law that you could have legal sexual relationships with people who are 17 in any state or territory, but if you have a photo of that person, you could be committing a crime in most of these states for child sexual abuse material. So I found these sorts of ironies within the law, the inconsistencies in which how it was applied, And also just the fact that it was censoring certain types of media over a broader spectrum of media, really, I suppose a lot of people being caught up that shouldn't be caught up within the intention of the law. So that's how I got involved in the project here. And I think the project is a very good project, very, very well articulated. I'm not as familiar with the AI and all the other stuff currently discussed. So I'm really excited to hear all the other experts talk about the impact of AI and other forms of places around the world and the censorship of that.
Thanks, Ashley. We'll get Zora to give her response.
Yes, I got involved with the project because Jeremy posted it on a responsible tech forum. And when I saw the description, it really kind of captured my imagination to think about different ways that AI and tech exacerbate differentiation in the world. So that tech, I think years ago, you heard people talk about the digital divide, right? That some people can use tech and other people can't. And slowly that conversation has really died off, but it's died off for silly and disingenuous reasons. The fact that people can shop and post videos on social media doesn't mean that they are tech savvy. They aren't understand, you know, there are still a lot of people who don't understand platforms, who don't feel welcome in these spaces, who have had very negative experiences for various reasons. And again, these are often based on identities. And I do deeply fear that AI is going to continue that, whether people are uncomfortable or they don't think it's for them or what they see troubles them. So in thinking about it from through the lens of sexual content, being able to look at these at AI as something that can help people, including abuse survivors, including people who are experimenting with creativity and in different ways, how can it serve the most people and be safe, right? How can we dig down and really differentiate things that are dangerous from things that are personal, maybe not meant for every context, maybe distasteful, but that shouldn't be restricted when users are in the correct environment. So it's been a very exciting project. It's been challenging for me. There are ideas that we have talked about, that we think about, that maybe I'm not always comfortable with. And it's very important to keep pushing on those and understand them better and talk to other experts that can help shape the ideas and the space more.
So Zora, I wanted to talk to you a bit more about that. So out of everyone here, I think you've had the most close connection with working on AI and platforms and what they're doing. Now, this version of the report, this edition of the report is mainly focused on recommendations to governments. But what do you think we can do about how platforms, as Emma pointed out, tend to overcorrect when it comes to sexual content? Is there a way that we can introduce into the policies that platforms have a little more nuance than that avoids this tendency to overcorrect?
Very good and interesting question. And of course, throughout, I'm speaking on behalf of myself and no company that I work for or have worked for in the past. I think a good place to start is that there are a lot of very smart and passionate people at tech companies working on these problems. Also people in nonprofits and in watchdog spaces. Governments, I think, are taking their sweet time in figuring out how to work with companies. And in some ways, I think that's the problem. There are these walls between users and the platforms and governments policymakers where everyone is a little bit afraid to do anything. So you have users who don't feel like they're getting a great experience, platforms who are trying to make everyone happy, and which, let's be honest, that's never going to happen, but then find a way to get there, to articulate their point of view. And they want to be working with policymakers to make sure that their product is compliant. But these discussions often aren't, they're happening behind closed doors. There's not a lot of transparency. And I think we are in a time where some companies, because not all platforms are the same in this, companies are wildly different in how they're approaching it, what kind of resources they're giving to these types of problems, how much attention and how much they're willing to talk about it. So when some companies approach it, they are being as permissive as possible and maybe not doing things that would keep users safe. Others may be struggling with overblocking, finding that Goldilocks space from a technical angle, from the angle of business, and trying to figure out what is going to make the most people happy is a real challenge. And I think the more discussion, and particularly positive discussion, can go on with platforms, I think that's the best case scenario. It's very easy. I do it myself every day to look at the news and say, platforms are not doing enough. Platforms are not doing enough. This is terrible. But to have everyone coming together a little bit more positively to say, okay, look, we know there's a problem. How do we start to unpack it and solve it from a place of positive thinking, wanting a better outcome, and getting more voices heard within that process?
In the report, we highlight that platforms often err on the side of over-removal to avoid legal risk. What patterns have you seen in how platforms define safety, and what impact does that have on artistic freedom?
Well, so when it comes to, say, tech, I would say a few years ago when, like, Don't Delete Art first began, what we were mostly dealing with was, like, directly with the platforms and trying to get them to understand artistic context and include artists' voices in their content moderation and policy guideline, like, enforcement and creation. Now, the real pressure is coming from tech policy and financial implications for these companies. They, as we know across the board, we know this from, like, when FOSSA SESTA was implemented, that when they are pressured to remove certain kinds of content based off of some, you know, a moral panic, ill-defined lines about, like, what constitutes something that is dangerous for people or not, then they tend to overcorrect and they remove a lot of speech. So this is something that is very pertinent and very serious, and that we could see happening in a lot of places in the future, happening currently. This has a lot of implications for the visual arts when it comes to laws dictating what kinds of content we are allowed to access or how we're allowed to access it when it comes to, like, say, age verification. And what that means for who's on the other end of that, whether an artist is going to be able to reach their audience or not. So,
Ashley, your research looks at how queer and trans creators engage with the fandom spaces. How do the moral panics around sexual or inappropriate content intersect with that participation?
Part of the problem is the fact that a lot of these spaces don't necessarily always feature a lot of trans and gender diverse representation. So whenever there's any sort of censorship, it reduces down the amount of representation you actually see within these spaces. So it is a real difficult navigating space to try and make sure that a lot of these fandom gatherings follow the law, but at the same time don't restrict queer creators and queer individuals from participating. So you have to constantly navigate that balance between the two, and it's not always easy. And so if in doubt, take the more conservative approach is usually the path that's taken. And unfortunately, that shouldn't always be the case, where a lot of queer media is being restricted, and it just parallels with the origins of Shotokon and Lolicon being from a protest against the BL movement of the 1970s in the doujin circles within Japan. So a bunch of disgruntled people were upset that that a lot of the creators were females creating same-sex male fan fiction, essentially. And so they wanted to create their own form of it, which was so repugnant it would put off all these female creators. And so that's where Lolicon came from. So it was a spark against queer female sexuality. And so I think there is a lot of parallels to today that we see within fandom spaces and the censorship of that. We haven't progressed at all in 50 years.
That's really interesting. In the chapter on South Korea, we also see that misogyny drives a lot of the content regulation there. It's actually was fascinating for me to learn about. And I'm hoping that for next year's version of the watch list, because yes, I would love to make it an annual report, I hope we'll actually get a scholar from South Korea to work on that chapter, and likewise with the other country chapters. So perhaps Australia, which I think three of us here are either Australian or have roots in Australia, I would love to just devote myself to that country, because as you've said, it's fascinating how many inconsistencies in the law there are in Australia. One of the other cases that I mention in the report but haven't mentioned yet in this discussion is that there's an author, a female author of a fetish novel in Australia, who is currently under prosecution for creating and distributing child sexual abuse material. And to be clear, the child sexual abuse material is the novel. It's not referring to any real characters. Even the fictional characters in this novel are 18 years or older. So this case is currently going through the courts, and the outcome is yet to be seen. But there have been previous cases in Australia where people have been prosecuted under child abuse laws for things like Simpsons parody cartoons. One of the other striking findings that I in the chapter on Australia is that the difference between fictional and real prosecutions are not tracked. So we may know how many child sexual abuse material cases there are per year, but we have no way of knowing how many of those relate to real victims and how many of them are over fiction, because neither the police nor the prosecutors keep those records, which really contributed to one of the recommendations of the watch list being that we should at the very least, keep separate statistics so we know where our public money is going. Yeah, I appreciated your remarks, Ashley, and I don't know if you want to add anything.
Yeah, I really like how you mentioned the fact that it isn't tracked in Australia. It's all conflated together. And I think that's really ironic, because child sexual abuse material is ranked into various different categories within Australia. It just isn't tracked when you submit it. So illustrated, artistic child sexual abuse material falls under category 6 of child sexual abuse material, because they've got a guideline from like the worst of the worst in the Australian law to stuff that's legal that you may question. So the fact that they have this guideline already, but they're not saying this is category 6 and therefore falls under this particular category, shows a lot of sloppy work when it comes to data management. Australia has a lot of issues. And when talking about censorship and also censorship of queer media. I think it's also important to note the youth social media ban that's come in to Australia, which prevents, I believe it's under 16s from accessing pretty much every social media, except for perhaps the ones that are most distributing of child sexual abuse material, like 4chan. But it does prohibit it. And unfortunately, it also disproportionately impacts a lot of queer creators and queer youth who rely on social media as outreach. So it's, again, that sort of censorship of and restriction and, I guess, punishment of queer youth in particular here. So that's another factor that hasn't necessarily been considered.
Emma, what do you think effective accountability looks like? How can platforms or policymakers protect both children and creativity at the same time?
Yeah, thank you for that question, because really I feel like I spent a lot of time just complaining and not envisioning a better system, but I do spend a lot of time thinking about that as well. And basically, I mean, I've said this for a long time, and now we get to sort of see a bit more of it in practice, but user choice to me is like the best way forward. Being able to decide what you as a viewer want and get to see, rather than the platform itself trying to walk that line and dictate what it is you get to see. You know, a lot of artists are experimenting with Blue Sky, trying to determine whether it's a good platform for their artwork. So far, there doesn't seem to be many major issues with the kind of artwork that they're able to post. The only issue is just, you know, who's there, what their reach is, because it isn't as, you know, popularized and, you know, just like grandfathered in the way that like Instagram is. People have to learn how to use it. And, but it means, though, that you could be able to, in effect, reach the right people, the people who want to see your work, the people who are looking for your work or are open to it, and that the people who are offended by it, don't want to see it, are not allowed to see it by, you know, maybe an age gate or something, then they're not exposed to it. But it doesn't mean that you get kicked off. I think that that's the best sort of way forward. Let's see how that goes. I'm also interested in smaller environments as well. I have long had a relationship with the people who run the Lips platform, Lips Social, and it's just a small platform that you have to apply in order to be able to post in it. And I've been part of some of that review process of reviewing applicants. And that's been a very valuable experience for me to be able to contribute to growing a space where a certain kind of like mentality is more welcome, which that mentality being an open-minded mentality, an accepting mentality, a mentality that is based around like artistic expression, because that is that space. But that space has been built specifically for like women, LGBTQ, and erotic artists to be able to gather and be able to express themselves without fear of censorship or being kicked off. So there are smaller environments. It depends on what you want out of your experience. It depends on what you need as an artist. That will dictate basically what kind of platforms you go to. And I just hope that these larger platforms that do have this kind of, I mean, base like Instagram, it's not that I want them to shutter or anything. I just really would love to see them be able to create a better model in which the artistic perspectives can be part of that design, and that our artists can be able to show their work and show their work to the people who want to see their work.
Zora, when you bring linguistic awareness into AI design, how do you translate nuanced human concepts like intent, context, or fantasy into something a machine can assess?
That is a question that some of the best researchers in the world are working on right now, because part of the problem when you're looking at it through a linguistic lens is that there are a lot of ways any one of those things can manifest, and there are so many variables that come into play. So how do you scale that out to see what is happening in AI? And there are a lot of different issues even with figuring out how to create and design testing mechanisms. Different companies are doing things in a lot of different ways. There's great research that's being released constantly. One thing I can say about the tech world is that people love to share. People are talking all the time. People are publishing papers talking about things like bias and intersectional content and dangerous content and showing smaller experiments. So when you take that all together, you start to get a picture. But has anyone figured out a great way to capture all of those linguistic nuances and kind of layer them one on top of the other to really get a sense of behavior that then you can talk to engineers about and say, okay, we need training data and we need to give the system instructions that can do X, Y, or Z. I think the tech just isn't there and the research just isn't there yet. So it's a huge challenge.
Ashley, I'm going to turn back to you. One of the fascinating things about your research, at least fascinating for me and I think for Brandy, because we're also immersed in fandom communities. And one of the things that you've mentioned is that these debates have been going on in fandom for a long time. You mentioned how there was a long history originally of women creating erotic forms of art, and that part of the backlash against that, is still going on today. So I would say that fandom has a mixed record of how it addresses these issues. The shipping wars, I'm sure, is well known to you. And I think some of the way that fandom has navigated this has been positive and some has been quite toxic. But let's focus on the positive. What have fandom communities been able to successfully do to ensure that people are not exposed to distressing content without their consent, without prohibiting those who are into that content from creating and sharing it with those who may choose?
Great question. I think to answer that question, basically, fandom spaces, especially conventions where a lot of this particular media is shared and distributed, fan creation is shared a lot more available. There is, I think, whether it's intentional or not, I think there is almost like a self-censorship of artists where they almost regulate themselves to make it more palatable to a wider audience. And whether that's good or not, I have my own thoughts that perhaps it's not as good to necessarily self-censor a lot of that erotic material. At the same time, from a marketing perspective, it also means they can reach out to a much wider audience that may not want as explicit content. So in terms of money, I think, you know, capitalism will win out. And in this case, I think there is that sense that it can reach a larger audience. And for the benefit of that is that also it means a lot more people can access and be introduced into queer media, boys' love, girls' love. A lot of this sort of creation and play with gender and sexuality within fandom spaces in ways that make it more accessible and then therefore make it, a safer space because you can see a lot more of this representation around. So there is a lot of benefits also to the real construction around, by self-censoring to an extent, it enables also a broader spectrum of inclusion and diversity that you wouldn't otherwise necessarily get.
Emma, have you seen any examples of good policy or platform design that strikes a healthy balance?
Well, as I mentioned before, I really like the Blue Sky platform, I think, is a good experiment, a good sort of opportunity for people to explore different ways that content moderation could operate in a more user-focused, like it's in your control way. I think that what we've lacked for so long and continue to lack on most platforms is any semblance of control besides self-censorship. And, you know, to what Ashley was saying about, you know, the self-censorship, sort of a go along to get along, that's totally valid, you know, and I think that's entirely right. And it's not like that's entirely different from the way artists have had to operate forever. There's always, you're putting your work out into the public. That's the way you get public. And there's always going to be some kind of self-moderation that you're imposing upon yourself. But the issue becomes about just how far that line gets pushed into those spaces and how far artists are having to self-censor and in what ways. And what we see on Instagram, for example, more recently is like artists whose accounts are being removed when they get those accounts back via various ways, whether it's through Don't Delete Arts Help, whether it's through a procedure that is like internal that they pay for, which I am morally opposed to and looking into. But they then will just go in and purge all of their own artwork from their own account just for the sake of maintaining their own just name online, basically their own visibility. And that's not sustainable. That is not about creating art that can exist. That's about erasing your own voice from a space in order for you to exist. And I think we see that in many marginalized communities as a not a sustainable way of existing in the world. So anyways, I do see a lot of these smaller spaces, more just intimate environments that where people are allowing each other to express themselves the way they want because they appreciate it. And I think that we're going to be seeing more of those spaces. People are kind of craving just acceptance from their peers and less about this being Instagram famous mentality, basically.
So, Zora, we've heard from a few panelists how marginalized communities tend to be impacted more directly by some of the restrictions on sexual expression. I was wondering to what extent cultural biases may be embedded in AI systems and what work is underway to maybe unpack that and to reverse those biases.
That's a great question. And there is so much interesting work going on, tons in academia, and even new departments, universities creating new departments that are looking at AI, human-computer interaction and AI with different elements of sociology, that this, it happened incredibly quickly, but it feels very vital. It's being taken very seriously from what I can see by different companies who want users to feel heard. They want that kind of quality. But the research is very fascinating in terms of there's so much to do. And in particular, if you're looking across the world, right? I tend to work in a US context, but I'm a linguist. I look at multilingual, multicultural spaces, and it's not clear how any of that works because the training data, if you look at AI systems as this amalgamation of the whole internet, and then the engineers have added these layers of safety, of training, where you, I think some of the first work done, some of the best safeguards I've seen has been about fairness and treating people with respect based on their identity. So you cannot get these systems often to use racial slurs, to use gender slurs. Even when you're looking at more personalized versions of products, even some of the products coming out of open source models where they aren't looking at certain content thresholds. Some models simply aren't good at doing it because they were developed that way. So as more research happens and more people get involved, because it really has captured the imagination of different groups who see this as something where they, a tech that could work for their group, that could bring something positive, and they are testing. I think everyone now who uses Gen AI does kick it around a little bit, right? Is this for me? Is this for the people that I care about? How am I going to challenge it to test that? I think that's very natural for humans. We are playful. We are mischievous. We want to see what it will do. And we want to see in some ways how safe it is for us. And through that, I think a lot of people have found things that they don't like, but also found things that they do. So with sexual content and how broad and intersexual it is, it is difficult to test all of the various things that could happen. But I think that users and companies and researchers are putting it through the paces, and it has been something that I've seen a lot of good research on.
That was such a rich conversation. Thank you all for bringing your expertise and compassion to it. I'd love to close with one takeaway from each of you. What's one change in law, policy, or culture that you can suggest that would help us draw the line more clearly between personal expression and lived abuse?
I think just bringing those voices into the room, like wherever these policy decisions are getting made, whether it's like tech policy in European Parliament, or whether it's in state governments in the United States or wherever, I think that bringing in the voices of the people who will be most affected by these things and asking about who is going to be most affected by this is really key, because for me, what I've found is that artists are rarely, if ever, in the room about any of these policy decisions that affect them. Like, it is very, very rare. And even Instagram, like, met with artists as a group once, 5 years ago, you know? And that was all, I mean, mostly for their own publicity's sake. But, like, I'm working on European tech policy, getting in the room on those levels, making sure that the civil society organizations that are in those rooms do know to keep artists part of that conversation. I'm engaging with research groups and human tech kind of conversations, just to make sure that they know that artists' perspectives are valuable to whatever they're doing too. So I think that it's just very key to ask yourself, who's going to be affected by this and how can we hear from them?
Ashley, we'll have you go next.
Yeah, I think I agree completely with that. Put those impacted first. And I think putting those impacted first is also to remember to put victims of child sexual abuse, real victims of child sexual abuse, before we put, you know, the simulacra of child abuse, the idea of conflating these novels with a victim of child sexual abuse really needs to be distinguished, and there is a line that needs to be drawn. And I think once we put actual victims of horrendous crimes first, we really then can reflect on whether the laws themselves are really fit for purpose.
And we'll hear from you, Zora.
I think my takeaway is that safety theater serves no one. At the end of the day, it doesn't do anything to keep vulnerable people safe or help them heal from these situations. If you're a platform or a company working on this, ultimately, people don't like you. Eventually, you will have an incident. There will be consequences of that in your business. And for policymakers, you look like cowards if you can't do things that have meaning. People do see through it. Will there be consequences right this second for your career? Maybe not, but they will come. And when people don't make the investments in this and come to it from a place of honesty, where yes, sometimes it can be very uncomfortable. Sometimes you have to educate yourselves on the things you don't know to contribute to this conversation and find the right path in your domain. Everyone wins when these issues are addressed, and they are addressed honestly with the correct resources and from a practical place, not a place where you want it to look good. The world sees through it. It has consequences.
Well, we could continue discussing this all day, but we are at time. So I'd like to take this opportunity to thank our three panelists, Emma Shapiro, Ashley Raminga, and Zora Rush, for taking the time to share their thoughts with us today. I'd also like to thank my co-host, Brandy Brightman, who you can catch every month with me on the Drawing the Line podcast. Sorry. What's the name of our podcast, Brandy?
Beyond the Filter. Maybe we should also have a Drawing the Line podcast.
Yes. And for those who are listening to us on the podcast, it's goodbye for now. But for those who are attending our webinar, we'll open it up for a Q&A next. So thanks again to everyone for joining us today, and bye-bye for now.